As always, subscribe and click the notification bell on our YouTube channel. Be active on our Facebook group, East Coast Distressed Note Investing, and be sure to go to our website for all your note investing tools, resources, and available assets. If you have any questions, email us at tradedesk@jkpholdings.com.
Hey, everybody. I'm Dave Putz from JKP Holdings. Alongside me, as always, Mr. Nathan Turner. Hey, Mr. Nathan. So you're traveling again, which is always good, right? So I'm really excited to get together with you today. One thing cool is we got to hang out together just last week at the Note Expo. For those who didn't know, in Dallas was really, really awesome. It was exciting to meet people we haven't seen in a while, connect with people new, and we made some really good connections. For those who weren't there, you missed out on a good time. So, Nathan, what do you think about what you saw? Yeah.
It's all about going to conferences. It's so important, and we've talked about that a lot of times, but it can't be overstated. It's so important out there, get in front of people, talk face-to-face,
yeah,
go grab dinner, whatever. It's a big deal.
Yeah. Difference. Yeah. And it gives credibility, right? People who may see you posting on social media and then seeing you in person and actually having that conversation is night and day for a lot of people. It just gives you the ability to network really, truly in person, right? So one thing we found, or I found at the conference, was this idea of people weren't ready for the next stage with note investing. I think we found a lot of people who didn't know what a bid calculator was and didn't know how to evaluate non-performing notes, who are only doing performing notes. And yeah, we both know performing notes are only going to be around for a short period of time. We're expecting everything going to change quickly.
Yeah, anytime
in the coming days. Yeah.
Yeah. Anytime you're looking at performing, it's always with the thought, this might go non-performing.
Yeah.
And if that's going to happen eventually, at some, to know how to deal with it. So it's sure, it's really important to know both sides of business.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. As you can see, Nathan's traveling a little bit, so you know, bear with his audio video. Hopefully we'll be able to stay on with us the whole time. When we talk about this stuff, one of the things we are very intrigued with is this idea of that the notes are going to be shifting soon. And we're expecting that. Nathan and I are be running our infamous 5-week note class starting back in January. If you are interested, feel free to go to our website, reach out to us about that. We'll be starting January 9th. For those who are not sure about it, take a look at the website. We teach how to build a bid calculator on there, a non-performing and performing bid calculator. We talk about due diligence, and it's a serious class for those who want to get to the next level. It's a really, really, really necessary process in your note development to get to the next stage, to actually have a non-performing calculator that includes things like statute of limitations and next due dates and foreclosure timelines and costs, because those things will kill you if you don't have them figured out. So Nathan, yeah, what were some of your takeaways that you learned from Note Expo that may have, you know, those who didn't go, they need to understand, or so they attend next one?
There was a really good session with some bigger note investors. So you had Chaz on there, you had Yanel, Bill Pimentel, and Chris from Kirkland. Yeah. And it was a really great panel. I where we're going to be causing our next recession. And it seemed like the was that affordability was going to be the thing. And yeah, my own personal opinion, I think it's going to be a combination of affordability and commercial crash, where people are not able to keep up with their. So I think it's going to be a combination of those two things that leads us into the next wave. And we're going to see much more of these defaulted paper coming our way.
Absolutely. I agree with you. So let's get into the thick of things. One of the things that came up really, really popular in the last couple of weeks was this idea of reverse mortgages, right? Outside the seller finance world, which we've been focused a lot on, and we're going to continue to focus on originations and seller finance, is this idea of this reverse mortgages. And I would definitely stay tuned in for the ending, because Randy's going to tell us about a lot of his successes and failures in that space, right? Because Randy's done more than just reverse mortgages. He's been a note investor for years. And we want to hear at the end what is best situation and worst situation he's been through in the note space. So stay tuned in for that. I've met Randy through social media and at conferences, and you know, it's great and necessity to connect with others who are experienced, because you learn from each other on a daily basis. And I think that if you don't do that on a regular basis, you're going to get behind.
Totally agree. Yeah, you need to know all the different options there. Just learn a few. Pick one and do one at a time, but know what the other options are.
Absolutely. So we're going to let I know Nathan's struggling with some audio, and that's okay. We can at least see his pretty face. And let's bring in our guest, Randy, on to the conversation. Randy's been in notes for a long time, but before I introduce him, let him introduce himself. Randy, welcome to our show. Share a little bit about your background. How did you get into the note space? How did you learn about notes? And what brought you into this world that we all enjoy?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, back in 2008 timeframe, I actually quit my job, my corporate job that I had for 18 years in 2008. And everybody's telling me, you're crazy. You know, you're going to go into real estate now. And truthfully, I didn't have a crystal ball, so I felt a little lucky, but really just got into initially just buying houses and, you know, the traditional fix and flip, or mainly creative real estate buying was subject to lease option owner finance. And then in 2000, roughly 11, I heard about notes, probably at a conference or something. I just, you know, heard a little bit about it, started digging a little bit more, and really jumped into it full time around 2011, 2012, and started buying notes. So I think I bought my first note in 2011.
Okay.
And, you know, it's been great ever since.
Wow.
Great business.
That's awesome. You know, it's so cool to hear from other people who are doing it for a regular business for this long. So did you get formalized training? How did you become successful?
Yeah, so I learned, I mean, the first notes I bought were really performing notes that I, you know, was trying to buy maybe in my IRA or 401k or something like that. And kind of learned a little bit during that process. And when I was buying those notes at the time, they were giving like a guarantee, meaning if the note stopped performing, they would buy the note back, less the payments you received. So I thought, how can I lose, right? So I jumped into it. And then I really started learning by, you know, looking at the note, the mortgage, the assignment, what do you have to do to actually buy the note, the purchase and sale agreement, the loan sale agreement, whatever you want to call it. So I really kind of got my feet wet there. But then there's a lot, you know, a lot more layers, right? I mean, the note investing space is really, I wouldn't want to say difficult, but if you don't have someone to help you, you know, it's nothing that's really intuitive. You have to, you know, you pretty much your attorneys are helping you, or you get mentored by somebody. I got a lot of mentoring through PPR, for example. So back then I was buying notes from them. They had a little bit of a course and some mentorship type stuff. So I really learned a ton through those guys. So that was really, really great. So that's really where I learned most of my note investing.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. They've been in this space for a long, long time. It's really cool to have a full circle. So you've been in the space as long as we have, plus what you've seen in the last couple of years is probably a lot different than you saw for the first 10 years of being in the space. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really changed. I mean, you know, starting off buying notes. Let's say we just talk about non-performing notes. You know, buying non-performing notes at, you know, 35, 40, 45 cents to the dollar. You know, back in 2011, because you think about it, when the market came down, it really didn't bottom until 2010.
You're right.
And then kind of hovered around and started kind of trickling up a little bit, but still the notes were still selling at a definite discount. And then it just kept going up and up and up and up. And then, you know, I was always saying, okay, 65%, that's going to be it. I'm never going to go past that. And then now we're kind of, you know, past that. So you really have to do your due diligence because you can get in trouble, right? You buy something and, you know, unless you have an exit strategy that's going to work, you could end up negative. So I was always very probably conservative, probably like you guys. And I always made sure it's going to work. Nothing's 100% in this business.
Sure.
But if you really look into it and really do your due diligence and, you know, look at a couple of exits, maybe it's going to be exiting through the house, through the homeowner, you know, maybe if you get it back, what happens? Can you fix it up? If you rented it, if you had to rent it, can you make money?
So yeah.
You have to look at every aspect of it. But
absolutely.
The notes are, you know, still a good business, but you have to really, it's a kind of more of a diamond in the rough right now in terms of the NPLs, but that'll change.
Yeah.
Will change, but there's still some out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for us, it became a different world because people got used to this performing world that just is just unique. I don't think I bought my first performing note the 2019. It just wasn't available. It was available, but it wasn't priced well enough because non-performers were killing in the pricing.
Right.
We're getting huge double-digit returns, 40, 50%. We get modifications and restatements and stuff like that. But things have shifted a lot in the last 3 years. What do you think's been the biggest shift in the market because of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, over time, a lot of it's just that the sheer inventory from 2008-09, you know, is starting to, you know, obviously get used up and depleted. But also, you know, just the shift in values, right? When the values go up on houses, the values go up on the notes. And as everybody knows, even before the COVID happened, the values of the notes and the houses, I'm sorry, and the notes was going slowly up. But then when the COVID hit, it really got more difficult. So now we're in a situation, you know, in my opinion, that, you know, house prices are at such a high level with the high interest rates that we're seeing a lot of people that get it under contract. And then it falls out of escrow, right? Oh. So if I have a house right now, this is a separate business, but you know, buying a house subject to, it's in escrow and then it fell through. This guy had it three times, it happened to him. So guess what? They're really motivated now. They have to move. And they've seen that this person couldn't get a loan. That's gonna happen more and more. So that's gonna produce more inventory of NPLs and so on for everyone.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's gonna take some time. But it'll get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for us, the non-performing world is something we got comfortable with, and the performing world got get boring. And how you calculate performing versus not performing are two different animals. I think people are going to have to really learn how to bid on assets that are performing today that will most likely default in the future. And they just don't know how to do that, and they really need to learn that. But we wanted to learn more about this idea of, and I just got a question before we went live, is reverse mortgages, are you creating them? Tell us about why are we talking about reverse mortgages? Are you creating reverse mortgages or are you doing something different with them, like buying them?
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm definitely not creating them. I'm not a originator. Never will be, probably. You know, God bless those people, but that's not what I do.
Yeah.
So basically just a few clarifications about what reverse mortgages are, things to know about reverse mortgages. So we're kind of on, you know, the same page. So the first thing is there's private reverse mortgages and then there's HUD reverse mortgages. When you hear the word HECM loan, that is a HUD product, meaning it's a HUD underwritten product. So HECM stands for Home Equity Conversion Mortgage. So those are reverse mortgages that we buy And, you know, typically the exit's through the house because sure. the people are usually deceased. The house is usually vacant. But sometimes we sell them at the auction. Sometimes it goes to sale. And then sometimes we get it back and we either rent it, fix it up and rent it, or just sell it, right, outright. So the other thing I think everyone should kind of know about reverse mortgages is, you know, the, so less important, I guess, on a reverse mortgage that's HUD backed, a HECM loan, those, the people can take the money and use it for anything.
Okay.
Yep. The private one, that they necessarily can't do that. But again, that's kind of not super important. The other thing is HUD requires the lenders to assign the loans to them once the person reaches LTV of 95%. Okay. So that's why you'll see a lot of times on these things that, you know, there's two notes and two mortgages.
Ooh.
Okay. So that's one of the major, you know, people ask, what's the differences? Well, that's one of the differences. So there's two mortgages and two notes, or two deeds of trust and two notes. Why? Because the HUD wants to make sure that once the lender can't put any more, and they get the, that they have to start making the payments, then they have security, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing you definitely want to remember.
So this idea of reverse mortgages is literally the borrower reversing the process of making payments, but instead of that, the borrower is getting payments up to an agreed amount, and that they're collecting income from their equity of their house.
Right. Yeah, I guess I should explain the basics of
it. It's all good.
I get a lot of times I assume stuff, but bottom line is, yeah, I mean, reverse mortgage, either one or three things happens. One, they get a big lump sum of money. Because they have equity. Let's say they have a house that's free and clear. They got a $200,000 house and they get a lump sum of 100 grand, or they get payments over time, or they do like a line of credit. That's probably, that's a pretty popular one. So the line of credit will be a certain amount. Now, that the other thing to note is when they get this money, of course, then they can use it for stuff. But a lot of times on the lines of credit, the amount goes up. And this is the beauty of why this is a good business. The amount goes up continuously. So for example, they can go up to 150% of the original loan.
Yeah.
So every year it goes up by the rate times the loan. So if the loan's 100 grand, the rate's 5%, that's 5 grand. So if the loan, the amount you can pull from it is now 105 instead of 100. Yes. And the next year it's 110 and so on. Again, wow. A little bit nuanced. We don't need to get into all that, but bottom line is, you know, a lot of the ones that we see, you know, they'll owe, you know, $300,000 on a $200,000 house. And you wonder, right, how could that happen, right? So that's where HUD kicks in, and they are basically guaranteeing that loan. And the other thing you definitely have to remember, besides the, you know, remember I talked about the two notes and two deeds, is the fact that there's a separate loan agreement. Okay, a loan agreement. Now, when you buy, and why is that different? That's a piece of paper that's not really your typical piece of paper that you see when you buy a note mortgage, right? Because there's three parties now, right? You have the homeowner, you got the lender, and then you got HUD. A lot of times they call it the secretary. When you see secretary, by the way, that's HUD. So you got those three parties. So that loan agreement is talking about how those people interact, right? What's the association? What happens when this happens? And again, it's a lot of nuance, but that's an important document to try to get. Now, what I found is a lot of times I'll buy these things and the person that's selling them won't have that document. I like to have it. Can you do without it? Yeah, you could still, you know, but a lot of, like the one I had in, I think it was in New Mexico recently, they really, you know, the lender, not the lender, but the attorney really wanted that document to go, you know, to prove their case or whatever. But we got through it without it. So, but it's really good to get. You're going to be more secure, feel a little bit better if you had that document. So that's another thing that's a little bit different from your paperwork, from your traditional, you know, note mortgage. And then the last thing I want to mention is, you definitely want to get a release of the mortgage lien, the HUD lien, which is the second lien, right? The subordinate HECM lien, which is the HUD lien, the Secretary of State, excuse me. And you want to get that release. Why? Because, you know, it's a second loan. You want that released off. And HUD usually, when they sell the loans, they just release it. They just sign a release and they record it. And, it, you know, it makes everything good. It satisfies that second lien. So those are the things you definitely want to keep in mind. Sure, go ahead.
I was going to say that most of the time when I buy those, that second is that's part of my collateral package is the release of that second lien. So like you say, it's really important to get that. But that's pretty typical that comes with it, but make sure, you know, trust me.
Yeah, make sure
you're getting that.
Yeah. Because again, that's something that's kind of unique, and that's why I'm mentioning it. You know, people are used to, if they're buying notes now and they're buying, you know, they're getting the note, the mortgage, the assignments, all those things you're going to get as well. That's all I'm going to be saying. But these are some of the things that are a little different. And like you said, Nathan, that's usually, you know, part of the package, so to speak. But it might not be something everybody's probably not aware of, and you guys can chime in on this, but a lot of times there's reporting requirements, right?
Yes.
If you bought some notes from somebody, or, you know, if you went directly to HUD, of course, you know, a lot of us don't do that, but if you did, then there's reporting requirements. Basically, HUD just wants to know what happened. We sold you this note. They would like you to sell it to an owner-occupied, or sell it to maybe a charity, or maybe rent it to somebody, you know, in such a way that it's, what they really don't want is just to flip it, but they allow that after 30 days. So typically you got to try to sell it to someone for 30 days. After that, you could quote unquote sell it to an investor. But you got to report that. And again, usually again, the seller would contact you and ask you to report, hey, what's your status on this note or that note?
So let's dive into more of, at what point does us investors get involved in any of this? Does this, as a note buyer, all this happens before we even get started, correct?
What do you mean? I'm not sure what you're saying.
So does the, when they originate this note, this is all done with the borrower being aware of what's happening and things like that, right?
Right.
When we get involved in it, this stuff's all created for us to make sure when we're looking at reverse mortgages, it's done correctly. Would that be accurate?
Right. Yeah. Everything's done. You're just taking all the documents and saying, okay, you know, just like you do typically when you buy a note, you got to make sure the assignments line up. You got to run title. But all those documents are there. You just got to, you know, verify, right?
Gotcha.
Verify that they're correct. You know, make sure the names are the same. Make sure that, you know, the addresses are the same. I've seen things like that. You know, you make sure your chain is good to go. So yeah, all the stuff is, you're not having to do all this creation of all these documents we're mentioning. I'm just mentioning some of the ones that are kind of unique that you have to get from your collateral packets that you get from your seller.
Sure.
And you want to make sure, obviously,
and then there's one more part of that, Randy.
Go ahead.
Sure.
One more important part of this is the servicing aspect. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because the servicing on these is a little bit different as well.
Yeah, good point. And then again, you can chime in. So basically, first of all, you got to find a servicer that will service it.
Sure.
Not all servicers service it. So what I found, I'll just tell you my experience. You can tell me yours. So the servicers that will not service it is like FCI. You guys heard of them, I'm sure.
Yep.
SN will not service it, as far as I know, unless they change. Who else?
Ally, why won't they service
Ally
it?
Won't service it.
What makes it that they can't service it?
Seriously, I don't know. They, I don't.
Okay.
I think they just decided they don't want to do that for certain reason. Maybe there's reporting requirements or something.
Yes.
But there are firms that do it, like Madison Management.
Okay.
Who else? BSI. Now, most of us don't use BSI because they're a little bit bigger, you know, folks that have more loans, a lot of loans. I mean, you know, thousands. But those are the two that I know. If you guys know of any other, let me know, because it's always good to know more. But who have you guys
used? I use Madison. And then I think part of it is their system isn't set up for it, because when you buy one of these, it doesn't continue to accrue interest the same way that a regular mortgage would.
True.
And so I guess is that their servicing software just isn't set up for it, or they don't want to have to change their normal or something like that. My guess. I haven't gotten a straight answer.
No, I think that's correct, because I had another one. I think it was a simple interest loan. It's a daily. Oh my gosh, it was really a weird one, and FCI wouldn't do it, and some other ones wouldn't do it. But bottom line is, I think you hit the nail on the head that it's, you know, remember, like Dave was talking about, you know, it's they're giving, you know, the lender is giving the homeowner money, right?
Yes.
So basically, it's not the homeowner giving the lender money. So everything's kind of reversed. So
let me just clarify real quick.
Set up for that.
Someone had a question, what do you mean by service? So in note space, we have servicers who act like a property manager. But in our space, when they collect payments typically from the borrower and they send it to the lender. So there's servicers who will not service a reverse mortgage, and some that do. And I agree. I think it's the way it's set up in their system. I'm sure Kevin probably is on here and maybe you'll explain a little more about that side of it. But it's the idea of how the property manager in the world of real estate is handling this loan, because it's not a typical loan that's set up like a traditional asset. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So you really want a servicer with everything you do in notes. I mean, you pretty much have to, unless you're licensed in all these states, and forget all that. It's just too much work. So yeah, you definitely need a good servicer to work with you.
Absolutely. So now it's set up, ready to go. What makes something, why would anyone buy a reverse mortgage?
I think one thing is people, especially investors that want to maybe get the real estate and rent it, or someone that wants to get the real estate and owner finance it and create a note that way. That's a great way to get a house at a discount versus going out and trying to find a house through the MLS, which, as we all know, there's not many, and they're very difficult to get at a big enough discount, right?
Sure.
This is a good way for even a fix and flip. Like, for example, I have a couple I just got back, and I have to decide, am I going to, fix it myself, upgrade it and sell it, or maybe just upgrade it to a rental quality and rent it, or just try to sell it to another investor as a wholesale type thing. So it really depends, but that's a good way. That's one of the reasons people do it. I do it basically because I don't want the house, but I can't really obviously work with the homeowners because they're passed away. But what I can do is, if I do get the house, my preferred method is to sell it with owner financing.
Good point. We had Rich ask a question. Can you do a wrap note with a reverse mortgage property?
Well, it's not a wrap note because I own the property now, right? So when I foreclose, I own the property outright. I have title. Yep. So I'm basically owner financing the house. So you have to go through, owner financing, the Dodd-Frank things you guys talk about on watch these guys' videos on that. But bottom line is, I sell the house as owner financing, follow the wonderful rules. And it's basically a note stream, right? I'm getting monthly payments. I get a down payment, monthly payments. And at some point in the future, they cash me out. Like, actually on Monday, I'm getting cash out of a house in Cleveland. And so I'm getting, I think I sold that house of owner financing about 2 years ago.
Okay.
And now they're getting bank loan. I'm getting all my money in it. And I sold it at a decent price for them and myself. And it obviously was a lot higher than when I bought the note for.
So at the end of this call, we're going to be going over what your best situation, your worst case scenario. So I'm looking forward to hearing that. And I wanted to quickly understand the fact that most people are buying reverse mortgages knowing the property's vacant. They go through the heir scenarios, make sure there's no heirs to collect it, and then they foreclose on it because the borrower is in default. It sounds kind of weird to say they're in default because technically they're getting payments made to them. But what are some of the triggers that cause that to be default?
Yeah, so it's really three things. If you look at the actual you know, the triggers for default, right? In the, you know, if you look at the mortgage and the note and the loan agreement. So really, transfer of ownership, that's one, right? The title gets transferred, they can call it due, just like a due on sale clause. Second is if the homeowner dies. Now, of course, if there's two people, like a, you know, husband and wife, or a, you know, their spouse, whoever it is, the other person can continue. That's not a problem. But if both parties pass away, or if there's just one, then they could accelerate the note and start to foreclose. The last one, if the homeowner moves out of the property and it's no longer their primary residence, right? If there's one person that's still there, that's fine, that originally signed on the note. But if someone moves out, no, they're going to kick it out and they're going to start to foreclose.
Absolutely. So we had a few questions come in too. If we bought a reverse mortgage note, should I continue to release monthly payments until I take possessions? Gee, no, right? You're not releasing anything on the note. It literally is in default, and your process is either A, foreclose, or B, talk to heirs, take over.
Yeah. So most of these, again, I would say most are a year to 3 years behind. So meaning it's in default that long. So yeah. they're not getting any distributions anymore from anyone. There's no one to give a distribution to, because the ones we buy, at least myself, are ones that all the parties are deceased. So so there's not an issue there.
Yeah.
Now, I have one question too from, I think that you forwarded me. I'm going to try to.
What we want to do is, if you're looking for some scenarios in PowerPoint, Rainey has a great PowerPoint for you guys to look at that we're probably going to go over today, but I would definitely encourage you to reach out to him. We'd share his contact information, how to obtain it. I'll repost it into all the chats so you can see it. For those watching on the replay on YouTube, feel free to take a look at it and go from there. So if you want to get the information, you want to learn more about it, see the PowerPoints, feel free to go ahead and take a look at that. And he can share it over to you. So just reach out to him, ask for the PowerPoint, and we'll go from there, which is awesome. So when you're going to this process of buying this asset, your goal is the fact that you're going to be foreclosing on this thing and taking the property back. Is there times where the heirs have stepped up in your scenario?
Yeah. So there's two things before I answer, or one thing before I answer that question. So
yeah,
my goal is not always, obviously, is not always getting the house back. So a lot of times I will price it at auction so I can try to sell it at auction. So, you know, maybe they owe $200,000. I might price it at 80 cents. So I price it at 150 at auction, and hoping someone, you know, third party comes in, buys the house at auction. And then guess what? I'm out of the picture. I just get my money. So as long as my spread between what I bought it for and what I can sell it to at auction is enough, then I'll do that, because my returns are higher, because guess what? You know, it's a time value money, right? It's a short time. So so that actually would be, right now, that's been my preferred, because I have a lot of houses I'm working on. So I'd say in the auctions of the last 20 that I've done, probably 70%, 60, maybe 67, somewhere between 60 and 70%. I'd say 2/3 go to auction sale, where it goes to a third party, because I priced it that way. Now, if I priced it for full payoff, I would get the property back each and every time, because they owe a lot more usually than it's worth. Yeah. But if I buy that particular asset at a value that's low enough, or a price that's low enough, then I sell it at auction. But getting back to your, I forgot what your question was.
It's okay. So it was about one of the questions we had was too, is does the deed change ownership? So Richie asked a question, does the deed change ownership to the investor now? I thought that triggers and puts a mortgage company on notice that the deed changed owners. So when you're buying this reverse mortgage, you are the lender on the situation. You are the mortgage company. So it's not that you're triggering, it's not a subject to scenario where you're like, there are all the big things going on we've talked about in the past was you're taking over some borrower's mortgage. You're literally becoming the bank. It went from Bank of America to Bank of You. And now you own the debt on it because of reverse mortgage in this scenario. Now there's other ways of buying notes, and we've done that, and we talked about that in many of our webinars, right? But this is the idea of you're buying a reverse mortgage. So you become the lender on file on a default of reverse mortgage. And now the deed owner, you're going to foreclose to get deeded ownership on that. Hopefully it makes sense, Rich. Cindy made a comment that I found a nice vacant property where the owner was deceased. The title search run and discovered there was a small line of credit plus a reverse mortgage. And then that note was assigned to USDA. It's been vacant for 2 years and no foreclosure yet. I hope that gets fixed, right, and whatnot. So they're making, trying to get a hold of the heirs. Absolutely. So that's probably the most challenging part, would you say, Randy, is getting a hold of the heirs to make sure that you've, well, any note you're foreclosing on, make sure that if a borrower is deceased, that you're notifying the heirs. Is that probably your biggest hurdle?
Yeah, because I remember the question now. You had mentioned the heirs. So of the ones that I purchased, let's just talk about, you know, we're talking about reverse mortgages today. Of the ones that I purchased, oh, I'd say, less than 5% reach out at all.
Wow.
So the heirs, I have had, I think the two I remember, one was they said, oh, we need, well, one was just, hey, I need to get some stuff out of the house. Okay. So I had to arrange that. Number two, the other one was, you know, I like to buy the house. Okay, great. Here's what they owe, or here's what's owed. Oh, no, forget, you know, they see that huge number and they're like, no, forget it. Right. So they're thinking they're going to get some kind of steal, but if they came back and they negotiated, I would negotiate with them, right? I'm not going to do it for the full payoff when it's worth, it's worth less than what's owed, of course, right?
Sure.
I'd come back if they came maybe in the 80% range, something like that, 85, I'd probably do it. But I haven't had that experience. Really, very few people reach out at all. So.
Gotcha. That's same with me. Hardly ever had it's usually just, we just go straight to foreclosure and that's it.
Yeah. So this fear of heirs, what Nathan was saying is that he's at the same scenario with heirs. Typically, no one bothers him. He goes straight to foreclosure, and typically the heirs don't hold up anything, right?
Really, they don't. I mean, you know, sometimes I've had some, you know, maybe ones in the past on your traditional notes, but probably I can kind of, you know, probably two in the last 10 years.
Yeah. So Kirk asked, so one of the things Kirk asked us was when you're trying to price this, how do you price these things?
Yeah, these are a little bit easier to price in my opinion, because you don't have to do all the calculations with, if you get the house back and you do a loan mod with them, you got to figure out what your return is going to be, right? So it's not always clear cut. These are fairly clear cut. So usually, you know, I'll price them, you know, based on the value. Of course, that's one of the most important things.
Yeah.
And then I would also calculate it based on the assuming I went my exit of 80% of the value at auction, right? Because that's what I'm finding is kind of the sweet spot. So if I price it at 90 cents, they don't sell at auction. If I price it at, anything much higher than 80, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't, right? Because I've had one bid up. Like I just had one recently bid way up past more than I ever thought. So it's kind of a guess game. But yeah, so you really have to price it. And so if you find a house that's worth, let's say, $200,000 and they owe $200,000 and you buy that note at $160,000,
yeah,
for example, then, you got to factor in your attorney costs and all that too. So usually, again, I price it roughly at 80% of what I could get at an auction.
But you're pricing an idea that you're gonna buy this thing, either owner finance it or sell it as is on the market. Ideally, you want to sell it owner finance and get that note back rolling. And then we have a few more questions regarding.
Yeah, just to clarify the pricing. Yeah. So I'm not buying it at 80% of the value, by the way. I'm assuming that if I sold it at auction 80%, how much, let's say that was 160, I better be buying at least, you know, 130, 140, right, to make a spread of $20,000-$30,000, right?
Yep.
So my return, I'm looking at, you know, 20 to 25% plus to get a return. Some are, you know, 100%, some are, but it better be at least 20-25% in terms of that spread between what I sell at auction and what I buy it for.
So, Rich, I would suggest you reach out to us directly. I know you're asking questions. It sounds like you're more in the owner finance W-2 world and that you're not sure how we can foreclose an owner. We're become Bank of America. Bank of America can foreclose on anyone. If you take on their debt as Bank of America and they assign a debt to you, you have the ability, just like Bank of America can, to foreclose. This is the world of buying the note versus originating the note. What he's suggesting is once he has the property, he then creates a note then after he's already foreclosed on it and remove the borrower in that position. Feel free to reach out to us, Rich. We can explain a little bit more off air. Absolutely. So we're curious too. I know, you know, Nathan shared some of his off air stories and we're going to get to some of the fun stuff now. Can you tell us the best deal you've come across? What was something that can you, you don't have to remember all the numbers, but tell us the best scenario, a little story of your deal.
Boy. Think about this one. I don't know. I had a lot of good ones. So let me think. I guess the ones I like, I mean, I could talk about ones where I made a ton of money, which I made a ton of money in a lot of them. But some that I feel good about in terms of the story, I guess I'll tell one of those instead, which, you know, I also made money on. And actually this one, it wasn't probably the biggest money maker because it was a kind of a low value note, but
while you think of that real quick, one quick question came up was, do you always have to foreclose or can you get a deed in lieu from an heir instead of foreclosing?
Yes, you can get a deed. Well, you can talk about the reverse mortgages.
Yes.
Can you get a deed in lieu? Well, it depends. So if the title is, you know, you have to look at the title, right?
Yep. Meaning, and deed in lieu means that you're exchanging a deed in lieu of foreclosure for those who don't know. I apologize.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, typically deed in lieu only, you can do that when the title's pretty clean, doesn't have a bunch of liens on it, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, who can deed it over, right? Well, they're both passed away. So an heir technically can. It have to go through probate, and the probate, I mean, then the heir would have to get control of the property. And I don't do that.
Yeah. So it can happen other than foreclosure. So where would you say one of your best deals, if you have some numbers, ought to be even better? What states are you typically buying this in? And what was the state that you bought probably one of your better deals in?
I've purchased notes in 32 states now. You know, I think there's a couple in Virginia and in West Virginia. Virginia one kind of sticks out where I bought the note. It was a house where the people really didn't want to keep the house. I had bought the note at a pretty good discount and they decided to leave. So, I think on this note, I bought it at, I don't know, low hundreds, like 100, let's say 100 to make the numbers easy. The house was probably worth 180 ish, but it did need a little bit of work. And so I tried to do a loan mod. Obviously my first goal is to keep the people in the home if they want to be in the home, of course. And try to modify it. Because truthfully, if you modify a loan, you can usually make more money, right? Yes, but that's not really the goal. The goal is, hey, I don't really want to fight with anybody. If they want to stay in the home, I'm going to try to make it so that they stay in there and work with them. But these people did not. So we did, in that case, we did a deed in lieu because they had a pretty good clean title. They didn't have any, you know, IRS liens or state tax liens or whatever judgments. So we got that done. Once we got that done, we took hold of the property. I found some people up in that area that are contractors to, you know, rehab the property. Again, I never do like full on, you know, HGTV rehabs. No, that's not me. I do flooring, the paint, and whatever else it needs. Maybe it needs, sometimes it needs whatever, stove or whatever. If it needs a lot of work, I'll just pass it on. But this one needed kind of, you know, enough. So I even did some countertop work, stuff like that. And I sold it a 189 over higher than I thought I was going to. And I bought the note for 100. You know, that was a pretty good deal. I mean, I've had several like that, you know, in the past, which the great thing is it was pretty easy. You know, I agreed the homeowner, we're not, it's not a contested, you know, fighting. Yeah. I don't want to fight anybody. Right. So it was a deed in lieu, easy. Got the house back. Yeah. Long distance rehabbing is not easy.
Absolutely.
And I can give you some pointers on that one, because I've done it. Like every
no, thank you.
20 states now. So I got some pretty good teams in certain states, but
yep,
most states are very, it doesn't matter. It's long distance, right? It's hard. Yep. But it does pay you off more. You get more money. But sometimes, like I got one right now in Oklahoma, I could probably get it $70,000 more, but, you know, I'm going to sell it to this investor and just get rid of it, because, you know, sometimes you got to use your time wisely.
So with reverse mortgages, have you had a bad deal go?
The reverse mortgages?
Yeah. Have you had a bad reverse mortgage deal that just went south?
I'm trying to think. Not really. I feel I'm pretty, like I said, I vet them. I vet the notes pretty well.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of anything. I mean, I have two properties right now that I got back from reverse mortgages that I fixed up. They're on the market now. They're selling a little slower than I wanted. One, okay. I got an offer yesterday. And the other one, I don't know, something about Mississippi. I haven't gotten much offer, and it's a nice house. But I'll make money no matter what happens on those. But, you know.
How messy is a house when you walk into those things that have been vacant for 2 years? How much?
Well, that's a great thing that I'm glad you mentioned, because I was going to mention this and I forgot. One thing you want to see is, because this can be a huge cost to you, is if you buy a house that's reverse mortgage or whatever, and it's vacant, it's been there for a while, usually they have all their stuff in there still. Sometimes they're pretty clean. A lot of times they're not. I mean, I had one recently, I had to spend over $5,000-$6,000 just to get the stuff out of it.
Trash outs.
Oh my Lord. So, you know, if it's a big house, a lot of stuff, it can get super expensive. So make sure you look at that stuff, right? Make sure you determine whether that's worth it. Or you just got to put it all, it's all in the equation, right? You got $5,000 for the attorney fees or whatever, you know, I'm just making up numbers, but you know, if you get the house totally clean, well, that number might be zero. But some of these houses are in great condition. Actually, some of the reverse mortgages, most of the reverse mortgages are in pretty good condition. Why? You think about it. It's an old, you know, grandmother and grandpa living in the friggin' house, right? They're not trashing their own house, right? They wanted to stay there in the first place. That's why they got the reverse mortgage. They wanted to live there till they died.
But it's been vacant for 2 years. You're hoping that the lender puts some kind of, you know, winterization on the property if it's up north, or, you know, board it up, put a lock on it so that you don't have any people, you know, squatting. And
yeah, I mean, you're going to get stuff that happens, right? Yep. But usually, you know, you do the securing the property, winterizing it. I had, you know, somewhere, you know, they still go in and steal the HVAC copper or whatever, you know, and if it's in a bad area. So that's why you got to pick and choose.
Yep.
But that doesn't happen a lot with those, because usually those are in a little bit better, you know, decent neighborhoods.
Yeah.
It's a lot of little things you got to figure out along the way to make sure it works. And, you know, I think, but if you do that, you'll be fine. I mean, you don't know. Some things you don't know, right? Like I had one, I thought the HVAC looked nice, looked at the outside unit, blah, blah, blah. But guess what? It didn't work. I had to replace it. And that was an extra expense I didn't expect.
Yeah. Or
the gas company comes and turns the gas on, and guess what? The gas is leaking in the house, the gas pipes. So now I got to replace the gas pipes in the house, right? So,
oh my gosh.
You got to, you know, this is not a game where you play that, you know, got to have some capital.
Yeah. So, Nathan, we'll let you, I know you're having audio still issues and whatnot. We'll let you finalize our session here and get a crystal ball out.
Yeah, sorry, the bad reception. We're in the middle of Wisconsin someplace, so it's not great reception. But yeah, we always like to kind of find out from our guests, what do you think? What do you think we're in for? What's coming down the pipe? What's your vision for the next 2-3 years with the note business?
Yeah, I think right now I wouldn't expect. I think house prices are going to stay stubbornly high because the basically the supply is low. But what I am seeing, there's a lot of people that are having a hard time selling the house just because the people that are buying can't get a loan. Because why can't they get a loan? Because they have high price and high interest, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to be hard. So there's going to be some people that have problems, not just only selling their homes, but making their own payments. Some people bought it way too high during the COVID time, right? So there's the 1.9 million mortgages out there that, you know, were in forbearance at one time, never really got through the whole scheme of things. They're over 120 days, they're more like 600 days late, you know, past due or whatever. So I think we'll see more, but I would not think in the next, I think it's going to be, probably towards the end of next year. But again, I don't know for sure.
Crystal ball is always
a little fuzzy. maybe towards, you know, you're always going to have, first of all, just remember everybody, you're always going to have non-performing notes, right?
Yes.
Good times, bad times, always are there, right? So don't say, oh, I'm not going to do it right now, right? You can't really predict. You're always going to want to be going in, looking at them, finding the diamonds in the rough, and then there's going to get easier because there's going to be more. So get your feet wet, learn from these guys or whatever, and take the leap, right?
Yep.
There's always going to be notes out there, but I think there's going to be more coming down the pike. But in terms of, you know, the note business, obviously the seller finance world is, you know, look at the numbers. There's more and more of those being originated. Why? Because people can't sell their house, right? So that's a good area to be in, seller finance notes, either buy them, buy the parcel, whatever, you know, you guys talk about a lot of that stuff. And, you know, I buy some of those as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's always a place, right? Just like the market was bad when you're just a traditional investor buying properties, right? There's always good times and bad times, but you just, you know, I was buying houses 2007 before I quit my job. I was buying houses at the peak. But guess what? I was buying 20% below the market.
That was about the pricing.
Yeah. So when it came down 20%, guess what? No big deal. If it came down 90%, would I be hurting? No, because it was paying, right?
Yeah.
It's a paying house. Those were rentals, right?
Yeah.
So as long as you have cash flow, you're okay. It doesn't really matter what the market does. It's like a dividend, right? If your stock goes up or down, it doesn't matter. You're still getting your dividend, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the market will even itself out. We looked back and said that Gen 6, 7, 8, the market dropped not by 100%. It dropped by a little and came back up. But if someone needs a place to live, they're going to have to keep paying their bill. You're going to have some defaults, but things are going to keep going. And like you said before, there are always non-performing notes. And it's not because the market. It's a borrower died. Someone got sick. Someone lost a job, divorced, you know, credit card debt, housing debt, kids situation. Million reasons why loans go default outside the economic part of the space. So I think you're absolutely right on that. So I really appreciate you just kind of putting yourself out there and giving us your crystal ball and just idea from an experienced investor, what you come to say. So I appreciate you coming on with us and joining us for this Friday afternoon.
Great. Appreciate it.
Feel free, guys. This will be recorded. It'll be on YouTube, on our podcast. And like I said, in January, me and Nathan will be running our advanced class, which is a 5-week advanced class, which I highly recommend you just check out. Because if you're not ready for it, when this thing comes at us, we'll enjoy the returns while you guys are stuck with the performing notes, getting your little 10-12. And when we're jumping on the non-performing world, right? So we encourage you guys to jump in that world, but make sure you do it smart, safe, and intelligently, because you can get way beyond. So Randy, once again, hang on for after hours. I appreciate you coming on and joining us live. And for everyone else, have a great weekend.